It's a already well-known habit of German academics to start with apologies. So,
this is my rule.
Yeah. Just to say that, or what?
To do it.
Yeah, you did it.
Yeah.
You were in length. I make it short. I just apologize for after all these elaborate papers. I think I have only a couple of very simple things to say, and this is, I think, due to the fact that I was asked to give a position paper, which I never did before in my life. And usually, I'm more or less a historian, and so I love to speak about objects, about texts, about images, paintings. And I never gave a position paper before, so excuse me for that. This is an experiment in a position paper, and there was even the desire that these position papers should be polemical, and so you will see what I brought up. I call this the map is the territory. When I read the expression, the map is not the territory, for the first time, it occurred to me that it contained the quintessence of Anglo-American philosophy of common sense. The defiant, insistence on a logic of representation, a common sense belief in the evidence of an objective reality, which is prior to all mental representations or written representations, a normative concept of rigor and scientism. All that appeared to be concentrated in that one expression, which Alfred Korzybski coined in a paper on the necessity for rigor in mathematics and physics in 1931, and which certainly can be looked at as an emblem of analytical philosophy. I do not, of course, wish to put up an argument like the one that Jacques Derrida and Jean Searle once had in England, and I will certainly not address the historical issue of the divide between so-called continental and the analytical traditions of philosophy. I'm happy to learn here that the center for research in modern European philosophy was named because they wanted to circumvent the expression of continental philosophy. So this historic divide that, according to historian of philosophy Michael Friedman, goes back to, or can be traced back to, the clash between Heidegger and Carnap in the early 30s. I only wish to use this expression of Korzybski, who certainly was a partisan of Carnap, to point out the media philosophical impact of what in Germany now is called a study of cultural technologies and cultural techniques, which constitutes a new and rapidly expanding field of research and teaching in Germany since approximately a dozen years. The media philosophical core of this research field can be seen as the unfolding of the possible meanings of negating Korzybski's negation, namely that the map is indeed the territory. One of the possible meanings of the sentence, "the map is the territory," can be found, of course, in those maps which were invented by Lewis Carroll and Jorge Luis Borges, maps of a territory of an empire in the scale of 1:1. In Lewis Carroll's, Sylvie and Bruno concluded, a German professor tells the story of how the German mapmakers had experimented with the use of always larger maps until they finally produced a map in the scale of 1:1. I quote, "It has never been spread out yet," said the professor. "The farmers objected. They said it would cover the whole country and shut out the sunlight. So We now use the country itself at its own, as its own map, and I assure you it does nearly as well. Borges' text, The Rigor of Science, relates of an empire in which the art of map-making had reached such a degree of perfection that the cartographic institutes were contented only with a map of the empire that had the size of the empire itself and was congruent with it in each of its point. And in the end, the map and the empire became indiscernible. But it is not this interpretation of the sentence that the map is the territory that is relevant for an understanding of the media philosophical core of the concept of cultural techniques. As cultural techniques, maps are not just representations of a territory. First of all, this is just a footnote for myself, they can also be representations of notion. Second, maps are not just representations, but also instruments. They are based on mathematical operations, and they constitute a substantial part of a cultural practice. A main feature of the analysis of maps as cultural technologies is that it considers maps not as representations of space, but as spaces of representation. The historicity, which is of interest in the first place in connection with those spatial representations, is not the historicity of the represented places or spaces. Instead, it is the historicity of the space of representation itself. From the perspective of cultural studies, as well as from the perspective of the study of cultural technologies, maps contain less information about a territory, but rather about the way it is observed and described. But the hermeneutic or cognitive approach, which is predominant in cultural studies, I think at least, reads the map as a key to the understanding of the intentions of those who produced the image of the world which is displayed by the map. Hence, understanding maps here means to understand the intentions, the conscious and unconscious dispositions of the authors of the maps, their worldview. On the contrary, the media philosophical approach inherent in this study of cultural technologies reads maps as media or mediums, I'm not sure, which themselves are agents of subject constitution. The marks and signs on a map do not refer to an auctorial subject, but to epistemic orders and their struggles for dominance over other epistemic orders, in the course of which marks and things enter into a new place of science. The cartographic operations produce a subject, first of all, which correlates to them. So in this point, I completely agree with Boris that the subject is not dead. It's constantly and has been constantly reconstituted and reinvented as, of course, something which is not itself the origin of constitution. Such an approach does not consider a map as a representation in a twofold way, neither in the sense of a denotation nor in the sense of a reflection of the cultural predisposition of an auctorial subject. It is instead concerned with the way how changes in cartographic procedures give rise to various orders of representation. Instead of representing cultural predispositions, it is its very basis of production. What in the approach of hermeneutics or cultural studies is used for interpretation is that what in the approach of cultural technologies and techniques is in need of interpretation. Representation is not presupposed, but itself an historical event which appears at a certain date in the history of cartographic orders. Maps thus appear as sources of a history of representation and not as representations in a history of intentions and their cultural conditions. The concept of cultural technologies and techniques is not post-media. Not at all, I think, in the sense that it is designed to replace the concept of the media. and the mediums. But it is definitely, I think, post-new media, in the sense that it suggests to interpret media studies as something completely different from internet studies or mass media studies. It is designed to set a new perspective on mediums and perhaps also on media, namely to relate the concept of media historically to ontological and aesthetic operations. We had an example here, which process distinctions that are basic to the sense production of any specific culture. In the 19th century, the term cultural technologies, in German Kulturtechniken, signified what in English was called agricultural engineering. That is, river regulations, for instance, but also techniques of breeding and domestication of animals. In the 70s of the 20th century, it was related to elementary techniques of education, reading, writing, calculating. When the concept of cultural techniques re-emerged in the context of media studies and German Kulturwissenschaft, shortly, not to be mixed with British cultural studies, shortly before the turn of the century, it was based on a post-humanistic understanding of culture. Thus, its spectrum could be expanded, for instance, to calendar techniques, legal techniques, or techniques of trance and the sacred. And in addition, it could find a systematic place in the context of history of science, legal history, art history, cultural anthropology, and ethnology. What was left out systematically, though, were the big explanatory models of a history of ideas and a philosophy of history, the progress of the individual and humanity, and the development of freedom on the side of idealism, the economical crises and revolutions on the side of materialism. Thereby, the concept of cultural techniques took up a feature which had been specific to German media studies since, I think, the 1980s already. This specific feature set apart German media studies from Anglo-American media studies, as well as from French and German studies of communications, let alone sociology, which under the spell of Enlightenment, on principle, wanted to consider media only with respect to the public. German media analysis placed at the basis of changes in cultural and intellectual history inconspicuous techniques of knowledge, like card indexes, media of pedagogy, like the slate, discourse operators, like quotation marks, uses of the phonograph in phonetics, or techniques of forming the individual, like practices of teaching to read and write. Thus, media symbolic operators and practices were focused that are today systematically related to each other by the concept of cultural techniques and technologies. The philosophical specificity of German media analysis in this at this period, it's today a little bit different, was that it took up Michel Foucault's concept of the historical a priori and later turned it into a technical a priori by referring the Foucauldian archive, concept of the archive, to media technologies. While in communication studies, sociological methods played a predominant role in German media studies, there was a link established between media and changes in knowledge and perception. Very much, of course, due to the reception of Marshall McLuhan. More precisely, what shifted into focus was not so much the question of what was represented in the media and how it was represented and why it was represented in that way and not in another way, since questions like that led always to the same answers. Content analysis of media products will always reproduce the same highly expectable results because it will always find what it already knows that it is to be found there. A Marxist will always discover the commodity form of contents, and a fan of cultural studies will always find race, class, and gender as the cultural semantics which govern those contexts. In contrast, To content analysis, parts of German media theory shifted the focus from the representation of meaning to the conditions of representation. The question is not how the map interprets the objective territory it represents, but what the techniques of our representations or but what the techniques or representation are it uses and how those techniques of representations is shifted towards the question of the conditions of representation. These conditions are not at all exclusively technical a priori, but involve the materiality of media in the broadest sense, including their technicality, discourse networks, cultural techniques, and formations of knowledge. The concept of cultural techniques highlights the operations of or sequences of operations that historically and logically precede the media concepts generated by them. So there has been calculating long before there was the concept of number. There was painting long before there was the concept of an image. However, although an operation like counting could be processed purely by the means of a body technique in the sense of Mas and Mos, it nevertheless always presupposes technical objects too, and be it one's own fingers. Calculation by means of an abacus give rise to another concept of number than calculation with one's 10 fingers and the paper surface and the computer yet to another concept of number. The media philosophical core of the study of cultural techniques and technology therefore consists, I think, of a vehement criticism of an ontological conception of philosophical terms. And I discussing media philosophy, I like to remind you at least that one of the origins of media studies in my country was that to do media theory and to do media history was one way to get away from philosophy. It was a way to get away from this master science of philosophy. So it's a little bit uncanny, this term media philosophy, because it brings together two things that at least 20 years ago I did not want to see together in a room or so, you know. But I'm able to develop. I mean, I can learn. I think the media, if there is a media philosophical core, I think it consists of a vehement criticism of ontological conceptions of philosophical terms. Maybe this is a compromise. Instead, research into cultural techniques aims at revealing the operative basis of those terms. So, for instance, there is no man independent from cultural techniques of homonization or anthropotechnics, as Sloterdijk put it. There is no time independent from the cultural techniques of calendars, time measurement, and synchronization. There is no space independent from cultural techniques of ruling spaces, and so forth. This does not imply, however, that writing the history of cultural techniques is meant to be an anti-ontological project. On the contrary, it implies more than it excludes a history of being, a historical ontology, which, however, does not base that which exists in ideas, adequate reasons, or an eidos, as it was usual in the tradition of metaphysics, but in media operations, which work as conditions of possibility for artifacts, knowledge, the production of political or aesthetic or religious actants. So this was my position paper. Now I have two more pages, which and I look at the
masters,
the master, the manager, the
moderator, capitulated subjects,
which is sort of appendix to what I'm, and
good.
Can I do that?
Yes, nice.
I also wanted to show a picture. It's not just because I wanted. It's because I felt so bad with this position paper, and I wanted to write about Velvet. An object. And and since I was starting with this sentence, "The map is not the territory," I wanted to present you at least a map and show you what could be a possible continuation of these theoretical framework into the practice of a theory of the image. And the image that I wanted to speak...
Excellent.
Yeah, I have it here.
Good.
It's can you
for the first row exclusively.
Only for the first. It's I will go immediately to an enlargement of it.
It's perhaps your computer could circulate.
I can let it circulate, but I'm afraid I will never get it back.
No.
I say what it is. It is in a minute. So the map is the territory, inasmuch map-making is a cultural technique which in the service of the state produced the territory as a political reality. And what I show you here, I wanted to project, is the allegory of painting by Johannes Vermeer, which is one of his most famous paintings, and I'm sure you all have seen it once. It's from 1665 to 67. It's all on canvas, and it's in Vienna, unfortunately. On the wall that you see in this painting, which sometimes called art of painting, sometimes called allegory of painting, you see a huge map, a map of the Netherlands, which displays on the right side the 7 Protestant provinces and on the left the 10 provinces that stayed under the rule of the Spanish Habsburgs. It's a very well-known map. It's very well, also very quite well distributed in paintings. So it's, Vermeer is not the only one who used this map in a painting. It was created by Klaas Jans Fischer and published after 1652. The metaphysics of space, which lie at the basis of the truism that the map is not the territory, originate from the cultural technique of perspectival image construction, in which the line rules over the color and the surface over the materiality of flatness. Linear perspective tends to develop technical distinctions between the eye and the imaginary space, abstract space and image objects, into metaphysical distinctions between res extensa and res cogitans, idea and matter, as, for instance, has happened in Florentine disegno theory. Although Vermeer was a painter who widely used perspectival machines like the camera obscura, his thematization of the image surface defines the image in a completely different way than it was done by Leon Battista Alberti. As the concept of representation is rooted in the principles of the linear perspective, it can be described as a historic version of hylomorphism, or hylomorphism. Following Gilbert Simondon, Deleuze and Guattari postulated what they called nomadic science as an alternative to this hylomorphism. And I think that the way media philosophy is analyzing the way how image spaces operate with the help of cultural techniques can be described within this conceptual framework. Hylomorphism is called a metaphysical relationship between form and matter, which goes back to Aristotle, in which is solely the form to which is ascribed the idea, the action, and being. Matter does not matter in terms of what is essentially needed for the being to be. Already the early Netherlandish painters like Van Eyck challenged this model of hylomorphism by favoring another model in which the pictorial ground, even the support, does not appear as passive, but as holding a potential which has always already initiated a becoming form, which is realized by operations like folding, weaving, or braiding. It is essential for this other model then that the operations which allow the matter to become form are inherent in the structure of the matter. They belong to the matter. They are expressions of the matter itself. In the model of hylomorphism, all the matter is assigned to the content, whereas everything which belongs to the form is transformed into expression. But in media philosophical conception of content and expression, each of the two terms does embrace form and matter. Matter here appears as a medium of singularities. With regard to the map in Vermeer's allegory of painting, the surface which represents the pictorial ground of an image is not a geometrical construction, but some kind of textile matter which is the medium of folds and bends and bubbles of colors. So
it's becoming difficult. Yeah.
Yeah. I have even a larger enlargement, and what you could see if there was a projection, the amazing thing is here that this map that you have in the background is not a flat surface. Vermeer did everything to show us how this textile, it's a canvas, the map is painted on a canvas, and this map is it's hanging on the wall like a curtain, and as like a curtain it has folds, and in the middle there is a knick. Peter asked me to introduce to tonight a new word into English language, and because I asked him what such a thing is in English, and the poor word that he gave me is it's a sharp fold, and I was not really satisfied with this. In German, it's a Knick. So let's introduce this into English. So in the middle of the Vermeer painting is a Knick, and art historians have written really tons of theories about this Knick in the middle of the map. But there's not only this Knick. There are soft folds and moreover, if you look very closely, the most striking feature of this map is that the color of the map is throwing bubbles. It's losing its context to the canvas, and these bubbles they run vertically through the whole map. Of course, they are not real, but they're painted bubbles, no? And they reflect the light. The light comes from the left side, and in these bubbles of color that goes loose, loses contact from the canvas, the light is reflected, and so that you have knicks and waves and folds on the surface, and so it is. Vermeer shows us that a surface is much more than a geometrical construction, like it is in the construction of space in a linear perspective. A surface is a volume and has a specific volume, a specific three-dimensionality. The complicated three-dimensionality of the fold. And, of course, it's not by chance that Deleuze wrote a whole book on the fold. And what we see here, especially in the upper left corner of the image, which you see here, there is a part of a painted ocean, and there are these folds which produce on the painted waves of the ocean other wave, huge waves, monster waves. And you have a ship. There's one ship, the painted ship, lots of ships. And there's one ship that sits on the top of one of those folds. And so what happens? The ship is casting a shadow. On the painted ship is casting a shadow on the surface, on the painted surface of the ocean. But the fold also is casting a shadow. So you have two shadows here. One shadow is casting on the other shadow. So one can ask oneself, when these painted ships sail over the folds of the pictorial ground, do they cast their shadow on the ocean or do they cast their shadow on the canvas? What is the difference between these shadows? Aren't they both painted shadows? Aren't they both painted on one and the same canvas? As the contours of the territory define the map as striated space, to use these concepts of Deleuze and Guattari, the structure of the canvas, the ornamental recursivity of motif and technique, the folds and bubbles which reflect the light, turn the whole map in an ocean into the smooth space par excellence. The map is the territory. That means, in this case, as the materiality of the map interferes with its contents, and as the medium of representation here interferes with the representation of the territory, for which representation is an ontological condition, the map as a representation is deterritorialized by the map as a medium. That's it. Finally.